Okay, so this case is called The People versus Kubat. And may I have the order of appearances, please, for the attorney general?
Jillian Prince, registration number 40815, on behalf of the people.
Thank you. And for the defendant, please?
Your Honor, Adam Mueller from the Public Defender's Office, on behalf of Mr. Kubat. My attorney's registration number is 42176.
Okay. Let me just start this last, if people get in and get settled, and there's a response. Seems to be a busy day. Okay, good enough. Mr. Prince, whenever you're ready, this is a half an hour case, so we have 15 minutes, please. Thank you, go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court. I'm going to take a dice roll. I'm going to take a dice roll, and I'm going to talk to you guys. Those are the words that Mr. Kutlak used. Those are the words that demonstrate that Mr. Kutlak wanted to speak with the police. And those are the words that show that Mr. Kutlak knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived his rights. Because there is nothing in the record to suggest that Mr. Kutlak's statements to police were involuntary or in any way coerced, the Court of Appeals' rigid application of the rule of exclusion was unwarranted, and this Court should reverse. In Miranda v. Arizona, the Supreme Court rejected the idea that confessions are in any way undesirable or unworthy evidence. Indeed, the Court specifically noted that confessions remain a proper element in law enforcement, and any statement given freely and voluntarily without any compelling influences is, of course, admissible in evidence. Here, Mr. Kulak's statements to Detective Johnson were freely and voluntarily given without any compelling influences. Now, the videotaped interview shows that Mr. Kutlak said, just after being advised of his Miranda rights, Mr. Kutlak said, I have a personal attorney, he's on retainer, can we get him down here now? In response to that question, Detective Johnson first responded to the temporal component of that request and indicated that it might be difficult to get the attorney down here now. But then Detective Johnson said, it's entirely up to you. Mr. Kutlak then said, is there any way, any long shot, that maybe we can work this out so I can go home today? Again, in response to Mr. Kutlak's question, Detective Johnson said, I don't know the answer to that question.
In your briefs, you seem to concede that this constituted an unambiguous invocation of the right to counsel. Do you mean to do that? Are you conceding that this was an unambiguous invocation?
Well, that's certainly what the trial court ultimately found and what the trial prosecutor below agreed to. Now, the trial court's ruling was... The trial court initially determined that the request was arguably ambiguous in as much as it was phrased as a question. The trial court ultimately found that it was unambiguous, and again, that's what the prosecution conceded below. This court, of course, is not bound by any party's concessions. Given the fact that the request was phrased as a question, and based on the trial court's initial findings, it is arguable that from the officer's perspective, the officer felt that this was an ambiguous request, such that a clarifying question was permissible.
But I'm correct, there's no discussion of Davis and its progeny, any of that in the brief, right? So this is not something that has been briefed for the court.
Correct. Now, Detective Johnson's response to Mr. Kutlak's question was not, however, in any way, shape, or form designed to elicit any information. It was not designed to dissuade Mr. Kutlak from exercising his rights. It was not, in any reasonable construction, the sort of badgering that Edwards or its progeny was designed to prevent. Detective Johnson's response was simply I don't know that we can get the counsel down here now, which reflects the fact that suspects do not have the right to instant counsel. Indeed, police stations are not required to maintain on-call defense attorneys to consult the suspects on demand. Now, given that this was not a statement, a question, or an action designed to elicit an incriminating response, there was no interrogation. Indeed, Detective Johnson's statement to Mr. Kotlak's second question, is there any way I can go home today, that too was not a statement, an action, or a question designed to elicit an incriminating response. So there was no interrogation after Mr. Kotlak said, can you get my attorney down here now? What Mr. Kotlak did then do was cut the detective off and say, I'm going to take a dice roll and I'm going to talk to you guys. That clearly constituted a reinitiation of the conversation at Mr. Kotlak's behest, not at the behest of law enforcement. Under those circumstances, there was no violation of the Edwards rule. The defendant relied primarily on three cases for his argument that this did violate Edwards, and each of those cases are distinguishable. First, in People v. Bradshaw, the defendant was questioned about sexual assault. The detective said, paraphrase the victim's assertions, and the defendant said, that's serious, I think I'll have to talk to an attorney. Instead of ceasing questioning, the detective asked, well, was that a consensual encounter? That touched on the crime itself, that touched on potential defenses that the defendant might have raised. That constituted a question designed to elicit an incriminating response, unlike the case here. Second.
Well, let's stay with Bradshaw for just a moment.
Sure.
Bradshaw arguably stands for the proposition that there needs to be some cessation, right? More than just not asking questions that are designed to elicit an incriminating response in a Rhode Island v. Innis interrogation sense, but that there actually needs to be some cessation of the contact. Is that not a fair reading of Bradshaw? If I'm remembering it correctly, I think there was at least some actual halting of the interview.
In Bradshaw, Perhaps Bradshaw and People v. Regible are the cases that address cessation of the interview. In this case, Mr. Kotlak reinitiated before the officer had any chance to stand up, walk out of the room, or physically separate himself from the defendant. Now, in another case, if the facts here were different, then perhaps an extended amount of time would have presented itself on the record, but Mr. Kotlak prevented that from happening with his statement. Now, in People v. Regible, there was, again, approximately a 30-second split between the invocation of counsel and the reinitiation of the interview, and under those circumstances, which I'll discuss in a moment, this court determined that 30 seconds was insufficient. Now,
it's Regible that I'm thinking of. Thank you.
Of course.
All right. And then we have the Dinka overlay there. That gets more complicated, if I'm recalling correctly. That's
correct. Yeah. Right. Well, and in Regible, the defendant was a Sudanese immigrant who had limited language abilities, and he had a translator with him during the interview. The records show that he had a diminished intellectual capacity. And his responses to the detective's questions were nonsensical and frankly, non-responsive. Under those circumstances, this court determined that the 30-second break was insufficient to constitute a cessation of contact. However, this case is very different from Richball. Mr. Kotlak is a native English speaker. There is nothing in the record or on the video to indicate a diminished intellectual capacity. In fact, he had vocational training and was employed as a mechanic. Additionally, his responses to Detective Johnson were on point, were indeed responsive, and there's nothing to indicate that he had any trouble understanding what Detective Johnson was saying. Additionally, Mr. Kotlak had several juvenile adjudications and at least one prior conviction as an adult, showing that he did have familiarity with the criminal justice system, whereas Mr. Regible did not have. So the circumstances here are vastly different from those in Regible. And under the circumstances presented here, 30 seconds, indeed 24 seconds, was an appropriate amount of time between the invocation and the reinitiation.
Could I ask you this? I know that you went on to say, yeah, if I stop feeling comfortable, I'll ask to stop. Was that immediately after the roll the dice comment?
I'm sorry, was that immediately after?
After the roll the dice comment?
Let's see.
Because that's not the way the way it's quoted in the briefs make it look. So I was wondering if there was something going on between those.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
If there was something going on between those sentences.
Between those sentences, what the video shows, Mr. Kutlak says, I'm going to take a dice roll, and I'm going to talk to you guys. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not going to do anything like that. Johnson says, okay. Kutlak says, I mean. Johnson says, well, I need you to be 100% certain and 100% comfortable with doing that. And then Mr. Kutlak says, yeah, if I stop feeling comfortable, I'll ask to stop.
Okay, thank you.
Of course. And now that statement, of course, demonstrates that Mr. Kutlak was aware and understood his rights. He knew that he was under no obligation to speak with Detective Johnson, and that if he did wish to stop, and if he did wish to halt the interrogation and wait for his attorney, he could do that. This is not a case where the law enforcement attempted to dissuade the defendant or trick him out of exercising his rights.
In fact, it seems like he was eager to talk, doesn't it?
I'm sorry?
It seems like he's eager to talk.
Yes, he was. He was anxious to speak with the police, presumably to tell his side of the story. And that happened with no coercion, with no badgering, with no trickery on the part of law enforcement.
I'm just wondering, since I haven't seen the videotape, does the body language indicate that?
Yes, there is nothing in Detective Johnson's body language to indicate any kind of badgering, any kind of coercion. There is nothing in Mr. Kutlak's body language to indicate any kind of fear or cowering. Indeed, my recollection is Detective Johnson is sitting at the table with his hands crossed, and Mr. Kutlak is sitting in the chair comfortably with his hands on the table as well. But there is nothing that would indicate a fearful response to Detective Johnson's question.
Is there an important distinction here between the right that's being invoked, it being the right to counsel as opposed to right to silence and putting us into a Michigan versus Mosley scrupulously in honor framework? Here, should we be more circumspect in a sense because we're talking about the invocation of the right to counsel as opposed to simply invoking one's right to silence?
Well, the case law indicates that the right to silence as well as the right to counsel must be scrupulously honored, of course.
Right.
In this particular case, though, given the facts here and given Mr. Kutlak's clear desire to not to exercise that right, even if he did invoke it, that allows this court to affirm the trial court's decision that suppression is not appropriate.
Counsel, before you take off, where is this defendant right now? I noticed that these events occurred in 2008, and he was in the current appeals case number was 09. He had a 3-year sentence. Is he in custody?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I believe Mr. Kutlak is in the gallery today. He served his sentence, and if memory serves, he was also present at the Court of Appeals argument. So, to my knowledge, without having looked at any subsequent histories, Mr. Kutlak is a free man today.
Thank you.
Unless this court has any further questions at this time, I would like to reserve my remaining 2 minutes.
Thank you. You can certainly do so. Mr. Mueller.
Chief Justice Rice, may it please the court. Good morning. My name is Adam Mueller, and I represent Lee Kutlak, who is present in the courtroom today. The Attorney General started by criticizing the Court of Appeals decision as rigid. I think that's maybe a fair description, but it is what the Court of Appeals was instructed to do by the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court has time and again described the Edwards rule as rigid, as per se, as bright line, and the Court of Appeals faithfully applied Edwards in this case. By definition and under the case law, an individual cannot reinitiate an interrogation that never ended in the first place. So I'd like to go back to kind of first principles. When the defendant invokes his right to counsel, Mr. Kulak did in this case, all questioning must cease, and he must be given a reasonable opportunity to consult his attorney. That's this court's decision in Romero from 1998. So there are two requirements, succession questioning and a reasonable opportunity to consult with a lawyer. I think in this case, Detective Johnson did neither of those things. He neither ceased questioning, and he provided no opportunity, much less a reasonable opportunity, for Mr. Kulak to talk.
I think the problem is, however, that Mr. Kulak asks two questions, to which they're responded very straightforwardly, no surprise there. I mean, what does a detective have to do? Immediately leave the room? I mean, the advisement has been given. You have the right to counsel. The detective learns that there is counsel, okay? And then immediately you have this couple of questions, you know, if I can't get them now, maybe I should talk to you. You know, an eagerness to engage.
Well, Your Honor, I think what the detective should have done here is when Mr. Kulak said, I have a lawyer, he's on retainer, can we get him down here now? And the detective responded, it might be difficult. The interrogation was occurring, my recollection is correct, 8 a.m.-ish on Sunday morning. It might have been hard to get in touch with him, but it might not have been. I mean, a lot of us have cell phones, we don't know. He could have gotten up and given the attorney a call. So what the detective should have done is say, because he has an obligation to give Mr. Kulak a reasonable opportunity to speak with this attorney, he should have said, okay, it might be difficult to get in touch with him. Let me see what I can do. Give me his information and then go try and get in touch with him. That's what he should have done. Because the whole premise of an unambiguous indication of the right to counsel, as Justice White said in Michigan v. Mosley, is when an accused invokes his right to counsel, he's expressing his own view that he's not competent to talk to the police without an attorney present. And as a result, courts should look with skepticism on later statements indicating a willingness to talk to the police without counsel.
The problem is, I think that they, I'll roll the dice, totally indicates that he knows what's at risk, but well, he wants to engage.
I'm certainly willing to, you know, it, had there been a break and had there been an opportunity for Mr. Kulak to talk to his attorney, or had Detective Johnson stepped out for 20 minutes and come back and said, you know, we couldn't get in touch with him, and then Mr. Kulak said, well, okay, I'll take a dice roll. That's a different case. But the course of pressures of interrogation are such that you can't, any statement from the defendant after he invokes his right to counsel is presumed involuntary. That's what Edwards says. That's what all the cases that follow Edwards say. And so, Schatzer, which is the case I discussed in my
Before you go to Schatzer, can you address the issue that I posed for opposing counsel about whether or not there really is an unambiguous invocation of the right to counsel here?
Yeah, absolutely. The trial court found it was an unambiguous invocation of the right to counsel and applied Edwards. The district attorney in the regulation is conceded, said it was a sufficient request. In the Court of Appeals, there was a concession from the Attorney General that this was an unambiguous invocation of the right to counsel. I read that concession to still be here today. We certainly have agreed the issue. I'm not sure it's encompassed within the cert question, for that matter, but I think, frankly, there's no question, even on the merits, that this was an unambiguous invocation. This court's last statement on that point was People v. Lynn from 2012, I believe. And Lynn, the defendant, said, when can I talk to a lawyer? My client's statement here, I have a lawyer, a personal lawyer, he's on retainer, can we get him down here now? Coming as it did immediately upon being told he had the right to a lawyer, having read Miranda rights, that's the most natural time to ask for a lawyer, and so I don't see any ambiguity there. And there really hasn't been any ambiguity briefed or questions of ambiguity raised along the way. I'm certainly going to, you know, I've looked at a lot of these cases in preparation, so I've got some other examples that you'd like me to go through. But I think compared to what this court has found under this before, I think I better have a lawyer. I think I need to see a lawyer. When can I get a lawyer? Those are all statements this court has found unambiguous to invoke the right to counsel. So turning back to Schatzer, because I think that is the case decided after this court decided Bradshaw and Reginald, written by Justice Scalia, and it kind of informs what I think the backdrop of this whole discussion should be. And in Schatzer, the court said that bright line rule, consistent with Edwards, that said if there's a break in custody between 14 days, or 14 days or more, between interrogation one and interrogation two, the police can reinitiate interrogation two. It doesn't have to be the defendant, and that's not a violation of Edwards. And the rationale, Justice Scalia said,
was that the coercive pressures of interrogation are so intense that when someone invokes the right to counsel, we cannot expect that their later statement to talk to the police, their later decision to talk to the police, is voluntary, generally speaking. But when you're out of custody for 14 days and you go home, you're in familiar surroundings, those coercive pressures have dissipated if they're long enough. And any later decision to talk to the police is, rightly or wrongly, a voluntary choice.
But may I ask you a question there? You're not suggesting by that a defendant has to be released from custody before he can reinitiate.
Oh, absolutely not.
And let me just take that a minute. From Edwards, from the U.S. Supreme Court cases, what do you take interrogation to mean when they say you have to stop further interrogation?
Yeah. I don't think they mean interrogation in reviving the innocence, strictly interrogation. If you actually look at Bradshaw, it uses words like interrogation.
And could you stick with U.S. Supreme Court for just a moment?
Oh, I'm sorry, I meant Edwards, I apologize. If you look at Edwards, what it says is interrogation, questioning, contact, exchange, communication. In Oregon v. Bradshaw, and this is on page 1041 to 1042 of that opinion, the defendant invokes his right to counsel, and the court says, quote, the detective immediately ceased or immediately terminated the conversation. That's the word they use in Oregon v. Bradshaw. So
and you take that to be the boundary concept. So basically, are you saying the policeman cannot utter another word before he moves the defendant out of contact with him?
No, and as I said to Justice Hobbs earlier, I think, I kind of asked a question. I don't think it's reasonable for me to say the cop has to plug his ears and sneak out. That's not reasonable, and I wouldn't expect that. But I do think having invoked the right to counsel, what the detective is supposed to do is say, okay, I'm supposed to give you a reasonable opportunity, so let me see if I can get in touch with him.
And why is that? Would you explain the rule then? If it's not that he can't talk to the defendant anymore, and it's not that he simply, you say that doesn't mean he can't ask the defendant a question, that's not what is meant by interrogation. What is? How would you define what he's allowed to do?
Yeah, the reason that I'm making this point and the distinction between answering your questions the way I just described or pointing his ears and running out versus, well, let's talk about the facts of the case. Those are all kind of on the spectrum of things that could happen. The point is, once you revoke your right to counsel, as I said, any proof statement you make after that is presumed to be involuntary. And so there has to be both a reinitiation from the defendant and a waiver from the defendant of the right to counsel. And any subsequent statement you make, without having had that opportunity to talk to a lawyer, should be viewed with great skepticism. And so, the longer, if the detective were allowed to just sit in there and they could talk about the Broncos for a while, the risk is you're still in, my client's in custody, he's not going anywhere. They're not going to let him go. So there's the risk that I can just prolong this out and kind of implicitly, kind of subtly, wear it down. Now, of course, the detective in this case did not make any threats. I'm not saying he did, and didn't, badger my client or yell at him. But interrogation and the pressures that exist in an interrogation are more subtle than that. My client was arrested at 3 p.m. on his front porch, or 3 a.m. on his front porch, and is now in custody for 5 hours, presumably hasn't slept, is in custody, he's not going anywhere. So the point is, you have to give that break so you can talk to an attorney.
May I follow up just one second? You keep talking about a break, but it's not leaving the room, and it's not stopping to talk to him at all. So I'm trying to figure out what it is, what constitutes that break that is ceasing interrogation from your point of view.
Let me clarify. I do think there has to be a break in the sense that the detective has to leave the room. I do think that. But the point I was trying to make is that it's not as if he has to pretend like my client didn't ask the question. He asked and plugged his ears as he leaves the room.
And your suggestion was that he should have complied and offered to get an attorney. But surely Miranda and Edwards don't require that, do they? It would have been all right from your point of view, would it not, if he had simply turned, left the room and said, put the man in jail?
Yeah, I think if he had said, we're done.
And if he said, we're done, put the man in jail, and then the defendant said, okay, in that case, maybe I'll talk to you, what would that situation be?
Well, I still think put the man in jail could be interrogation in a strict sense, in that sense.
So that would not be reinitiated?
I think it could possibly be police reinitiation as well. I mean, that statement is suddenly designed to get, I would say, the defendant to say something. It's a threat.
Even though you just said that would be entirely appropriate for the officer to do. It's just that that would not constitute reinitiation if the defendant responded to that.
Right. I mean, I think any statements my defendant made in response, my client made in response to that would be inadmissible as a violation of the rights of Edwards and the right to counsel. And so I think, again, the backdrop of Schatzer is a recognition of the coercive nature of being in custody, being in an interview room, having been arrested, knowing you're not going anywhere. Now, Schatzer, of course, is an extreme example, and I don't think you have to be released from custody. But the point, the purpose of the Edwards rule reflects the realities of interrogation. And here, that coercive, the inherently coercive nature of an interrogation, that never had a chance to dissipate at all, because 24 seconds after my client invoked his right to counsel, and without being given any opportunity, much less a reasonable opportunity, to speak with counsel, the interrogation continued.
What do you make of the fact that he said, well, I'll stop if I start feeling uncomfortable?
Yeah, I think that is a response that doesn't bear on the right to counsel question, that bears on the right to remain silent question. Because what...
It does, doesn't it? Because he's saying, well, I'll roll the dice because I can't get my lawyer here, and I'll stop impliedly, and we can get my lawyer here if I start feeling uncomfortable.
But of course, we don't know if he can't get his lawyer here, Your Honor, and that's the point.
So you don't think we even get to those statements?
Right. I think under the logic of Edwards and everything that's followed, basically, the inquiry stops after my client said, can we get him down here now? Now, I think the next statement by Johnson, well, might be difficult to get in touch with him. I mean, he's, like I said, he doesn't have to plug his ears. He can be responsive. But it's a wishy-washy answer. We don't know if it can be difficult to. Maybe the guy is up and could be there pretty soon. He's got to be given a reasonable opportunity to talk to me, to his attorney. We don't know if the attorney couldn't make it down there because no one made an effort to get in touch with him. And of course, the cop, as we said, could have been like, well, he wants a lawyer. I'm not going to interrogate him. The lawyer's not going to let me speak to him. So we're done. Fine, that could happen too. But that's the point of the Edwards decision, is Edwards recognizes that the defendant is saying implicitly, I'm not comfortable talking to the police without a lawyer. And so my client's statement 24 seconds later cannot overcome the presumption of involuntariness when he was never given that reasonable opportunity to consult with a lawyer, which he clearly wanted. And the interview, the contact, the exchange, the communication never ended.
But the impetus for Edwards seems to be the concern about badgering, that there's going to be a wearing down of the defendant. There doesn't seem to be anything here that is wearing this defendant down before he decides that he wants to continue the conversation. And this is, I think, all from Justice Hobson's observation.
Yeah.
So, what is the badgering?
Well, I don't think it needs to be badgering. But I would really urge this court to compare the interrogation here to the interrogation at issue in Smith v. Illinois, which I talked about in my answer brief on pages, I believe, 19 to 20. In that case, the defendant unambiguously invokes his right to counsel, and instead of immediately ceasing the exchange, the communication, that goes on to read Miranda, to finish the Miranda rights. That's not bad for him. That's not wearing him down. And at the end of Miranda, the client says, I'll talk to you. And the U.S. Supreme Court says, uh-uh. He invoked his right to counsel. The whole thing must end. That's not badgering. That's not interrogation about the facts of the case. The detective just continued to read Miranda. And even in that case, the Supreme Court said it violated the rigid rule, the bright line rule, the per se rule, whatever you want to call it, Edwards. And so there was no badgering in the sense of Detective Johnson banging on the table, certainly. There were no explicit threats. I understand that. And I certainly understand that when you watch the video, it can seem in comparison to other interrogations I've seen. It's not
that. So what if the detective had said, oh yeah, sure, we can work this out?
I'm sorry?
What if the detective said, sure, we can work this out?
Well, I still have to give him the reasonable opportunity to talk to the counsel.
I understand.
That would be interrogation.
So he didn't do that. He didn't continue to engage in the interrogation. He said, well, I'm not sure we can work this out. Plain advice that you're running a risk. Then I'm going to roll the dice. Why isn't this logical, common sense progression to the fact that he wants to talk, he knows he can get a lawyer?
Yeah, I see my time.
I don't get it. I mean, you know, the normal way people speak.
Mm-hmm.
You can answer that question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Because of Herrera, which says that you have to do two things, cease questioning and give the reasonable opportunity to consult with counsel. So 24 seconds later, my client says all the things you have said, he says, But that can't be enough to overcome the presumption of involuntariness when he has clearly expressed his desire to interact with police only through counsel. If there are no further questions, I would ask this court for.
Thank you very much. I think you have a little bit of time, Ms. Price.
Thank you. I'd like to first distinguish Smith v. Illinois, which my opponent has cited. In that case, the detective did continue reading the defendant his Miranda rights, but the detective also said that the defendant would, quote, have to agree to talk at this time without a lawyer being present. And if he did agree to talk without an attorney being present, he could stop at any time. The problem with Smith that is not present here was that the detective said that the defendant had to agree to talk at this time. That was a statement that was designed to coerce the defendant. Detective Johnson, on the other hand, did not make any such statement here. Second thing I'd like to touch on is when an interrogation ends. Now, an interrogation is defined as questions, statements, exchanges, actions designed to elicit an incriminating response. There is no requirement in Miranda, Edwards, Schatzer, Oregon v. Bradshaw, any of their progeny, or any Colorado case that requires a law enforcement officer to stand up, plug his ears, clamp his hand over his mouth, and hurry out of the room. This is not a script where a law enforcement officer is given stage directions when he must enter and exit. An interrogation ends when the statements, questions, exchanges, actions designed to elicit an incriminating response cease. And that is what happened here. Detective Johnson's responses to Mr. Kutlack's questions were neutral and non-interrogative. And the record shows, including the video, that the interrogation therefore ended. Unless this court has any further questions, the people respectfully request that this court reverse the court's appeals. Thank you.
I think we're good. Thank you, Ms. Price and Mr. Mueller as well. We appreciate your arguments. The court is going to be in recess for 15 minutes.